Okay, who's going to take notes?
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Assignment 4 is not up yet, but will be up today. So I also put up assignment 3 solutions. Otherwise, what I want to talk about today is, well, it's a couple of ways. It really starts with this idea of we'll say sandboxing. But we're going to go into a little more depth into this. So we talked about how virtual machines, hardware virtual machines and stuff, let you virtualize an entire operating system. And you know, here, and then you have the kernel is then talking to a hypervisor rather than talking to the hardware. And we talk all these different ways you can implement protection that way. What we're now going to talk about is, what do you do when you don't have the hardware to help you? Because with hardware virtual machines and with regular processes, the CPU is changing into different modes. And in these different modes, different resources are accessible. When you are in hypervisor mode, you can see everything. When you are in supervisor mode, you can see the page tables. It might not be real page tables, but you see page tables in which to manage processes. When you're in a process, you can't see page tables. You can't see those, register to access that. You can only see the user space registers. You can only see the memory that you have been given access to. You don't even see the virtual to physical mappings. You just see a virtual address space. And so this is the way regular processes are confined. And basically an analogous thing happens when you confine an entire operating system with a hypervisor. But in a lot of circumstances, we wish to confine code, limit its access, when in fact the hardware is not directly helping us out. The hardware is not implementing protection domains for us. It's not privilege levels or anything like that. It's just, it's essentially you're taking our model here, where you've got your source of hardware, hypervisor, kernel, running in supervisor mode, and then you've got your processes. So what we're talking about here is, how do I implement privileges inside a process? I want to subdivide it in some way. Now, before we talk about the how, we should talk about the why. In what sort of circumstances do you want to do this? Any system?
Maybe you don't want particular threads in your multi-threaded process to have the same level of access to different resources in the process as other threads.
That's possible, although if you're doing multi-threaded in a classic way, it won't work very well. You have to do something different. But I'm thinking of a very common use case.
Like a web browser to keep things separate?
Like a browser. A browser may be loading in arbitrary code in the form of JavaScript or WebAssembly into a tab, but it's not like that code should have full access to everything the browser can do. So it needs to be separated out, but it's not quite so straightforward because, if you're talking about a process, you're loading some code into memory and there's other code in memory, and normally we think of all the code inside of a process as running at the same privilege level. They can all access all the same things. But now we've got some code which is coming from, say the JavaScript and the web page, and then we have all the controlling stuff, and we don't want them to interact. Now I have to acknowledge at this point that actually modern browsers it actually uses OS level protections in order to better enforce isolation. Namely, the multi-process model for most modern browsers. I mean, Chrome has had it for a long time. Firefox has relatively recently switched to it. And so this idea that separate tab is running in a separate process. And so now it's like, okay, you compromise the process, all great, well and good, but the renderer that shows things on the screen is in a separate process entirely. So now the operating system protection boundaries is helping you enforce these boundaries. But for a long time, browsers didn't do that. And even if you look at modern browsers, that's just one mechanism. That's not the only way things are separated. So we talked about this notion of abstraction and, you know, and virtualization. And the idea that you have, you know, the subject and you have the resources and you have some sort of abstraction. And the idea is that when you virtualize, you're really doing this. You know, things are going through the abstraction to there. So what I'm talking about here is another application of this. Inside of a process, if you want to implement a means of control for changing how the subject is interacting with the resources available are the resources available to the process. But we still want to limit those from the particular subject, say, JavaScript code. We have to limit it by using an abstraction. What abstraction are we here talking about? The language runtime. You see in most languages that are higher level, that are not C, you don't have access to pointers. You don't have direct access to memory. You can't directly manipulate things. Sometimes, you know, in classic JavaScript in a browser, you can't even talk about files. You know, you don't have the standard kind of file operations. You maybe have these URLs you can access, which might have a file thing inside of it, but you're really accessing URLs to access things. If you're doing JavaScript on the server, they actually have to add additional APIs that aren't available in JavaScript in the browser. So by limiting the language, you know, you limit the badness that can happen. So you change the language. This is a little funnier than it appears, because we need to talk, now we're going to have a digression to think, how do you implement a language runtime? You know, what does that mean? And what do I mean by a language runtime? Because it has significant impacts on what we think of as the security properties that can be enforced. So your classic compiled language, you know, you have source, you know, maybe you have a preprocessor. You have a compiler. And then you have a compiler. You have a, linker. So normally you go here, preprocessor, compiler, to the linker, and that gives you a binary. So your source goes in, and a binary comes out. Classic, right? And this, the preprocessor here, what we're really doing, this is producing an elaborate source. This is taking the original source files, combining them together, like for example in C, you're taking the header files and adding them to the original source files. Here the compiler is producing object files. The linker takes a bunch of object files and combines them together to produce a binary. Is there a language runtime in a language like C?
No.
Actually, yes. But it's a little, but it's a very lightweight runtime. But there is a runtime in the sense that, you know, when you, if you have your code, you go int main, argc, argv, and you have your code here. the code that runs in the process does not start at the beginning of main. This is not the beginning of execution. In fact, a whole lot of stuff happens before this, especially on modern systems. If you do an S trace on your on a standard, you know, hello world binary, you will notice a whole bunch of system calls happen before the write system call that writes the hello world. And you did not put any of that. So who put it in there? That's the language runtime. And when I say a language runtime, I'm saying it's the set of code that provides the environment for your code. But there's one thing, you know, you write some code here, but then there's other code that has to make the assumptions that this does, you know, that it has come true. Like, for example, command line arguments. You know, if you're dealing with command line arguments, you expect them, you know, to be as arguments to main. Now, the kernel, as part of execve, does put those into the process address space, but it won't necessarily put them as arguments to main. So someone's got to set up those pointers. So language runtime, but it's even more important than that, because modern systems do dynamic linking. Dynamic linking means that libraries have to be loaded from disk, mmapped into the process's address space before the program starts running. Because otherwise, the code's not there. All the linker did is put in stubs. The libraries are loaded at runtime. That happens before main starts executing. So there's code that's put in here that does all this setup before your code runs. That's a simple kind of language runtime because it, you know, sets up the environment for it.
So like any language that's basically higher level than assembly has some sort of runtime.
Exactly. There's some sort of runtime. It may be very thin. Now, the C language runtime is really mostly about setup before you get to main. Once you're actually in here, there's a very close correspondence between the lines you write and the machine code that's run. There is, of course, supporting libraries. Whenever you call, you know, a function, you're calling some sort of library, but you could include whatever, you know, libraries you want. If you wanted to create C with some sort of weird runtime, you can, but it requires a little work. Like a GCC, if you tell it to run in verbose mode, it will actually show you exactly what it's doing. And part of what it's doing is it links in some, you know, some extra object files happening lying, and I think this one's called CRT1 or something like that, I don't know, but some little bit of code that gets added into the binary that you did not directly specify. So C allows you to potentially change these things, but really, you normally want these services, unless you're doing something really weird. But a program like the kernel will often have to do things a bit differently. It does not use the standard language runtime because it has to define everything. But of course, an operating system kernel is a combination of a higher level language, C or another thing, generally plus some assembly. Sometimes that assembly could be generated on the fly or whatever, but you need some low-level details on how the system actually runs because there's an abstraction gap between the language and what the actual hardware is. Following me so far? Okay. So a linker is just taking bunches of code and sticking them together so the references are all there. So when you call printf, there's, say, oh, printf, okay, where is the code for printf? Okay, that's here, so okay, let me, you know, make it so that you can jump to subroutine, you're going to, you know, get to the right address. Linkers resolve the symbolic references into actual addresses, either directly or they set up the infrastructure so that it can be done at runtime. But the compiler is taking the language in here and converting it into machine code. In other words, it's converting it into the language that the processor executes. Now, when we say processor executes, you should have a basic understanding that in modern systems, that's really not hardware. In the sense that modern chips, particularly x86 chips, but I think it's true even for ARM chips. Well, actually, I don't know about ARM chips, but definitely for x86 chips. The instructions that come in are translated into another language, into another lower-level machine code. And that lower-level machine code actually controls the different execution units on in the CPU and how data flows and all things. That's actually what's run. And in effect, there's a little compiler, in a sense, that's running in the CPU, directly translating that code as it comes in. That takes a good number of transistors to do on modern systems, but frankly, we've got so many transistors we barely notice anymore. So that used to be a major thing. And in fact, if you read up a little background stuff, there was a company called Transmeta. You all know, and Linus Torvalds, while he was working on Linus Kernel, decided, you know, I'd really like to do something else as my day job, went and worked at Transmeta. And the idea of Transmeta was that they would make an x86 compatible CPU, but it would do all, it would actually compile x86 instructions into another machine code, and the chip would actually run that other machine code, and they'd have a software layer that did that translation dynamically. And the idea is that that would be potentially more efficient. And well, first of all, you get the broad compatibility because it could run x86 code, but it would also potentially be faster than standard chips. And while Transmeta ended up failing, they did not do, but the ideas they used are actually very much in use.
I've used a couple of those Transmeta CPUs, and if I remember right, they were actually rather slow.
Right. Well, they were typically slow at startup.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the big problem, is context switching and kind of getting there. But if you're looking straight line code, they weren't bad. But it killed you, you know, when you had to switch context. But honestly, that's exactly what every modern chip does now, under the hood. And it's just because, you know, they have the resources. And that's faster. There's lots of reasons. Like, it gets into whole architecture and stuff. That's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about here. But why I'm talking about this is that there's this course, the compiler, there's this correspondence between the code that is that you give and the machine code there. I mean, you can walk through, GCC actually produces assembly language before it generates a binary. There's a GNU assembler in the mix. So you can get GCC to output assembly. And if you walk through that assembly, you can see line by line, oh, here's my C code, here's its translation to assembly. And C code and assembly map pretty closely to each other. That's just the nature of the language. Really a close correspondence. So you're going directly down to that. So what that implies is, in C, there's not much of an abstraction with which to implement control. I mean, there's a little bit of abstraction, like there's stuff before main that allows you to manipulate the environment in which the code runs, but when you're actually running actual C, you're basically running on the hardware. So that means there's not a place to do this kind of abstraction. But that's not the case for most languages. I mean, C is really the exception in this case. Other languages, there is something here, that the language does not directly correspond to what happens in the CPU. There's all kinds of weird stuff. I mean, you know, in JavaScript, you know, you have these objects which are really associative arrays, and you do lookups. I mean, when you do a lookup with a string, that takes some cycles to compute that. That's not going to directly map one-on-one, and there's all kinds of things. So, how do you have a language run like that? How do you get that to run the actual CPU? The classic way of doing this is something known as an interpreter. Interpreters are, think about how your shell prompt works. It's basically how it does. It gets a line, and it takes that line, and it figures out what, you know, code to run for it, maybe just for you, and it says, okay, here you go, run that code. And then it goes to the next line and interprets that, and the next line and interprets that, and if you have to jump it, you know, jumps back and goes back and reinterprets that. So it's a interpreters have the advantage that they don't have that much code complexity. Because really, you just have to say, okay, my language implements these features. I basically write a function to implement each of those features. And then I have, my interpreter is just basically a big case statement, you know, to a first approximation. It just says, okay, as we go through the file, oh, this is there. Okay, that means I call this function with these arguments. Okay, this line's here, I call this function with these arguments. And there's a lot of languages that really are, you know, like that, other languages that have more layers on top. But that's the classic interpreted model. But the interpreted model has high code density. You don't need a lot of code to implement it, but it has low execution efficiency because you're having to do the translation as you go through the source code. I mean, it certainly allows you for nice, fine-grained control. I mean, because in the interpreter, it's very simple just to add a little bit of code. It says, I don't know if you're allowed to do that, and have it say no at appropriate points when it tries to access something. So if you are trying to access an array bound that is outside the bounds of the array, you can very easily say, oh, is this array in bounds? Yes, no. And if it's not, then you signal an error, array bound, crash the program. In C, classically, you can't do that because the loops correspond directly to CPU instructions. And so if you iterate past the end of the array, there's no code checking that because you didn't put anything in there. Strictly speaking, if you wanted to do bounds checking in a C loop, you would add in your own bounds checking. Which is a little bizarre. But that's what you should do in C, classically. But in an interpreter, you can very easily say, nope, we're going to decide how this runs. So the question is how can we get the efficiency of a compiled language, but with the safety of an interpreted language? Does anyone know what the modern term for that is?
Just-in-time.
Yep. Just-in-time compilation, or JITS. Nothing to do with the faculty member our department. Yeah, that really isn't his thing. But just-in-time compilation is the idea that rather than interpret the code as you go and incurring the overhead of trying to translate the source as you're executing it all the time, instead, let's take some of the code and compile it and then run it. And you run that code for a while, and then you compile the next, and then you run it. So if you just naively think about this, you go like, this is dumb. Compilers are slow. If you keep doing this compilation as you run the code, that means that, you know, this is going to be really, you know, inefficient. How do you get around it?
What does it have to do with the fact that it's just like something like amortized, like you only compile once and then with every other references, you just go back and re-reference.
So amortization is certainly part of it. And it's part because most of the time spent in code is in loops. So since you're in a loop, you still, even if you're in just-in-time compilation, you have to compile it when you do your first iteration of the loop. But then every other iteration will be compiled. So you get full machine speed. So that's the first benefit. But still you have the cost of, what about all the code where you're not looping? Then it's like, okay, it turns out the way you get around this with just-in-time compilation is you have different compilers. Because you could always have a trade-off when you have a compiler of whether you're going for efficient code or efficient compilation. I mean, you can think of efficient compilation is really just looking things up in a table and saying, oh, here's some boilerplate code, use it. Here's some boilerplate code, use it. Optimization is all about looking at the code for patterns and saying, okay, yeah, you're doing this. Oh, look, you did the same thing 5 times. Okay, we can stick that out there, and now you just have to do it once. And so we save time. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy optimizations that compilers can do, but those optimizations take time. So one way to get around this is you just have different trade-offs. So like when you first run the code, sometimes you have like, okay, first time we run the code, we just interpret it. know, if we run it up multiple times, do we compile it? Modern systems, they just have a really fast compiler that doesn't necessarily produce very efficient code. They do a quick compilation, run it, instrument the code, and notice when they get to code that is going to be run more than once, run many times, and say, oh, let's compile that again using a more, you know, let's spend the time to optimize this code. And then when they do, and then they run it. And so modern runtimes for, you know, higher level languages, the good ones do just-in-time compilation. And so when they do this, they can actually be very close to C in speed for a couple of reasons. One is because, you know, the compilation gets amortized, but it also turns out they can get additional efficiencies which you often don't find in regular C code. You think you're writing all efficient code, but you're running it at a very low level. And because you're running at a low level, the compiler doesn't know as much about what you're actually trying to do. So it's limited in the kind of optimizations. But in a higher level language, the compiler has much more information. It knows about the kind of thing you're trying to do. So it can take much more aggressive optimizations. So you can, in some contexts, beat C. Now the contexts are slower. You know, it's never a pure thing, but this is how, if you look at some of the benchmarks for, you know, good just-in-time compiled languages, modern JavaScript can be remarkably fast because, you know, just, they've got a lot of tricks, but the code to run the JavaScript is complicated. It's very complicated. So now this gets us into back to security. So now you have this funny thing where, you know, if we stuck with a pure interpreted language, where we're doing our interposition, where we're doing our permission checking, where we're doing our restrictions is very nicely defined. But when you start doing just-in-time compilation, now you want to compile it to code. You want that to be efficient code. So you could put in a whole bunch of checks at runtime, but a lot of those checks will be redundant, will be unnecessary. So your compiler tries to do some things of saying, well, actually, we don't need that check, because I already made sure that we're not, you know, like, this array bound is, we've already guaranteed it can't be out of range, so here we don't have to do the check. So we can drop an instruction there, like that sort of thing. But that's potentially dangerous if you make mistakes. So the language will implement certain semantics. You'll try to implement those. The just-in-time compiler should keep those to be true, but there often are bugs. And those bugs can potentially allow you to have access like C. And thus now you've corrupted your memory safety. Or maybe you can access something that you're not supposed to. I mean, it just, when you increase complexity, you have more opportunity for bugs. So how do we get around that? How do we make sure that we keep things safe?
Run both the interpreted code and the compiled code, see that they're following the same path.
So, the classic, kind of, not quite. What the real way that is used, which isn't used in all systems. JavaScript doesn't use this, but Java does, is you use a mix of both, which is you say, instead of the compiler producing a binary, we produce bytecode. And the bytecode is then run by a just-in-time compiler, which compiles it down to actual machine code. Now, one advantage of this is that now you don't have to deal with all the parsing stuff and all things. You know, you just have nice bytecode, which you can make specifically optimized for translating to machine code. But in the bytecode, you can add richer information than is in your standard machine code. You can add in type information. You can add in like the size of arrays. You can, all these things for enforcing whatever constraints you want. You can annotate your code in your bytecode with those. And thus, and because you've added this to the bytecode, the information's there, and because you don't have to deal with all the compilation mess, it's you can be running less code and potentially have it be more, maybe more efficient and potentially more safe. That's, you know, so that's what Java systems do, is you compile it to bytecode, then you come over here and run it through the JIT, and the JIT will enforce all the safety properties you want, and you, but it could potentially be more efficient. And also it does runtime optimization. Can also note when the runtime optimizations that just-in-time compilers do can actually be much more fancier than regular compilers because they have access to one stream of information that regular compilers don't have, which is program behavior. A compiler can say, oh, I'm just going to optimize this code because, you know, I should try optimizing everything. A just-in-time compiler can say, well, you know, this code's run all the time. This code doesn't. Oh, this code always seems to have followed these regularities. I mean, a just-in-time compiler can actually even do unsafe optimizations because they can add in code to say, well, let's see if I think this assumption holds. If this assumption holds, like that's if A is greater than 5, then this code's going to just be this. And so they just have to do that check, and then they can take the fast path. But when and if that check fails, they go like, oh, darn it. And they can switch to another version, or they could just recompile it from source. So just-in-time compilers can actually be faster than regular runtime, and so when you also use an intermediate language, like a bytecode, it's faster still. Now you'd think that this would mean that a Java runtime would then potentially be smaller than a JavaScript runtime, because the Java runtime is dealing with bytecodes, and the JavaScript runtime is just dealing with source code. So you have to deal with all the source code stuff plus all the runtime stuff, you know, the other stuff. That's not so true in practice. Java, you know, the Java, you know, JREs, they're kind of complicated. Some of that complexity is due to the fact that a lot of them are really fast. I mean, they've got what? It's not just like two compilers got fast and slow. They might have like 3, 4 or more versions of the compiler to run in different circumstances. So that boosts your code complexity. But there's another factor at work. You know what it is? Language complexity. JavaScript may be very dynamic, but it's not that big. It's not that big of a language, relatively speaking. I mean, it's getting bigger. It's got some more features, but it doesn't have a crazy feature. Java, kind of big. It's got lots of different things, not just in terms of the library, just in terms of the syntax and the different semantics and how you declare things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there. And when you make the language more complicated, the thing that runs the language has to be more complicated. And even worse, Java implements kind of an operating system. What I mean is that in JavaScript, the protection model is relatively simple, in the sense of you have, you know, there's closures. That's really the protection model in JavaScript. It's a closure. It's saying, okay, I have this function, it can access these variables. There's the local scope, there's the, you know, the let's go other scope, and I've packaged that up into this thing so I can only see certain variables. And okay, this one can see those things because it's in this let's go scope. This one can't see those things because, hey, it's inside this function. This, you know, they can't see each other. That's what you're looking at. It's a little funny to understand, but it's the semantics are pretty consistent. They're relatively small, and they're not that hard to implement. I mean, closures take a little bit of funniness, but it's not nearly that bad. That's not what Java does. Anyone know what Java does from a security point of view in terms of its permission model? J-
Java implements a full access control mechanism. You've got a it's basically an operating system. But the operating system units are not processes. It's objects. You have objects that can have privilege and objects that don't have privilege. And when one object is privileged and it calls an unprivileged object, it normally gives that other thing its privilege. Like, you can think that maybe you have like some sort of string class. String class should not be privileged, right? But then let's say, you know, something deals with some sensitive data now requires some privileges. If it wants to manipulate strings, that thing's going to have to inherit those privileges. Otherwise, it couldn't operate anything. So, I mean, if you just think about the semantics of this, you go, like, how do you pass around the privileges? How do you label these things? Under what certain, I mean, it turns out it's complicated because it's actually designed to allow it to have multiple entities running code and accessing sensitive things. I mean, think of like a really complicated business, you know, enterprise with all these things. I mean, they've kind of built that whole permission model that you might want to have for business logic into the language, which in some sense is like, oh, it's good to have support for all these things. But it also means that all Java code has to potentially deal with that. You know, you have that whole complicated runtime. But let's just talk mechanistically. How would you do permissions inside of a process? Now, we do have an enforcement point because, I mean, we have the language runtime. So we know when one function calls another function. But how do we enforce that? How do we decide at runtime whether this is actually allowed or not? Because it's a dynamic property. It can't be proven. It can't be done statically. How do you know who's allowed to do what? It falls down to a rather simple concept, which is it's based on who called you. It's a call stack. I am not an expert in Java. I have colleagues who are definitely know this stuff, but I am not an expert in this. I can tell you some stuff about this, but.
But you'd have to start the stack with the highest privilege.
Exactly, class loader.
Yeah. So how would you?
Yes, exactly. You have to raise privileges and drop privileges and things.
Okay.
So I mean, this is just like an operating system. The thing, the first process that runs has all the privileges. And then it has to drop privileges in order to, you know, run particular user space processes and unprivileged process. And then maybe you may have to have some way of that being able to call a privileged operation. You know, like things like sudo, you know, sudo and set UID and all those things. You have Java equivalents of all that stuff. But the basic idea of this is it's doing it using the call stack, because the call stack tells you who called who. And so anytime you're doing a potentially sensitive operation, the Java runtime has to do stack introspection and go like, okay, we're trying to do this. How did we get here? And based upon who called who, the action will be granted or not. So part of the complexity of a Java virtual machine is dealing with that whole stack introspection game. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, it's there in Java SE, and there's even more complicated permission models in the enterprise version and stuff like that. But most of the time, does this make any sense whatsoever for most code we run? No, it doesn't. These permissions were used to great effect for one particular class of Java application, Java applets. And the idea there is you would have Java applets that would be signed, or Java applets that were unsigned. An unsigned Java applet would be sandboxed, would not be allowed to do too much. But a signed Java applet would be able to, you know, access the local file system, be able to do whatever it wanted. So this is really useful for like adding a browser plugin which you wanted to now all of a sudden upload a bunch of files. This is why you used to have a lot of Java applets for saying, oh, I want to upload a bunch of photos, and so I'll make a Java applet, and since I'll sign it, then it'll have full access to the file system, be like running code, and then it can upload all the files, because regular JavaScript code can't do that, because that would be a security violation. But of course, just asking people to okay sign code is kind of dumb, because people don't know. You know, it's like, it's just a silly thing. It's like, give away all your protection, yes or no? Maybe because I trust them? Trust them for what? I mean, you're just asking people to make decisions that there's no reason they couldn't make a good decision. I don't even care if you're technically sophisticated. It's just, you just can't make that decision well. But just stepping aside from that, how do you implement this? Signed code versus unsigned code. Who's checking the signed versus unsigned code? It's the Java runtime. So now the Java runtime has to be able to decide, oh, this Java code can access the file system, but this Java code can't. How does it do it? This is with, you know, this is the permission model, this is with the stack introspection, this is all that stuff. You might go like, wait, have an operating system solve this problem? Didn't we already have that? You know, why are we doing this at a language level? But it's not portable. Right? Because we want our language to do everything, and we don't want to depend on what the operating system does, so we're going to re-implement everything. And one of the things that has really done Java in is it made these various security guarantees, and if you look at the history of Java, you'll find all these occasions where those security guarantees went out the window. Because it turns out trying to do the stack introspection stuff is kind of complicated. Way more complicated than trying to, you know, just, you know, have hardware enforce things for you. It's really complicated, and you have all the other complexity of trying to make the thing run fast. So you get levels at all stages. You get implementation bugs. You get semantic bugs where they didn't realize that by declaring this class with this permission and giving this one this permission and allowing them to talk to each other, like, oh, now the attacker can run arbitrary code. Oops. Now, it's not that the people who did this were stupid. I mean, it's an amazing engineering achievement. It's just, this sort of complexity is the enemy of security, simply because you can't get it all right. And why can't you just leverage? I find it really interesting that you know, we had all these things implementing permissions at the language level, and we've kind of more thrown those out. But not completely. Anyone know what I mean by not completely? If I'm talking the modern context, I'm probably talking about web browsers. If I'm talking about web browsers, what am I talking about?
JavaScript.
I'm talking about JavaScript. But I'm talking about something in particular. What is privileged JavaScript in a browser? It has a name. It's called browser extensions. Same problem, different context. We're in the same boat. Because now we again have a language, we again have to implement protections. But now what do? The protections are for things that are being loaded from the local file system. And does anyone know how, you know, about browser extension permissions? So it used to be with like older, you know, Firefox and, you know, Netscape before. Their browser extensions were originally just, here's some code you load into the browser. And since the browser actually used JavaScript to implement its interface, and it had this whole thing called Zool, which is this XML interface specification thing for manipulating stuff. So a browser extension literally just sort of went in and added JavaScript and added Zool and added those other objects and could just change completely how Firefox worked. Chrome, on the other hand, said, we don't completely trust these extensions, so maybe we should implement a permission model. So just like Android apps have permissions, Chrome extensions have permissions on things that they can and can't do. And similarly, like Android, the permission model's a bit broken, but that's a separate question. Firefox now has given up on their Zool-based extensions, and instead, and they've moved away from that as their interface paradigm, too, and now are implementing have implemented an extension interface compatible with Chrome's, because they need also a permission model, because they can't allow arbitrary extensions to mess with the browser too much, because it corrupts the integrity and there's potential for untrusted extensions. But Firefox does potentially allow for you to do more things in a more fine grained. It has extensions to that model. But again, this is not, this is the same problem we had. So, question?
Oh, I was just going to say, if you asked you if you heard about, it kind of relates to this, Firefox just implemented the Facebook containerized solution for Zuckerberg consistently leaking your visa to Cambridge Analytica. So they made, I was reading about it yesterday, I think I got it wrong, there's containers, and there's a unique section of cookie IDs for each different browser tab, and apparently if the tab is Facebook, there's an extension tool you can download that like pretty much disables, I guess, the monitoring activity to an extent. I'm not exactly sure how.
So the idea of this is that, in effect, it's like running Facebook in its own browser.
Right.
So the information leak they're trying to do is that because of the way cookies work and other tracking technologies, the state, Facebook has all these ways of, when you're logged in, of tracking you across the web. Because any page that has a like button is also talking to Facebook. And so it can also access it. So that combines, it can access the Facebook cookies and it can access the DOM. So it knows what page you're accessing, all the things you're doing, and can send that back to Facebook. So that's the basic monitoring technology of the web. It's mostly server-side, but using the certain key information in the browser. By, in effect, doing it in separate browsers, that's what container is. It's, you know, like we were talking about, containers separating things. You just have, you know, here's Facebook's container. When you browse the rest of the web, it tries to access, it's like, oh no, we don't have those cookies. We don't have any of that stuff. You're logged in over here, but everywhere else, it seems like you're not there. So Firefox is in particular doing a lot of things to mess with this. And this is part of where I think, if you look at their extension technology, I think they've taken the Chrome model and extended it in certain ways, which allows it to enable further privacy protections.
So then who's going to pay for the web, though? Because that's what was, like, right, when you browse the web, you're essentially, oh, you want to load up this free web page.
But that's, it's not an ad blocker.
Yeah.
It's not an ad blocker. It's a tracking blocker. I actually think tracking protection is a very different thing than blocking ads. Because it's just about, you know, I can bet, you know, pay, you can pay more money for bad-and-believe targeted ads, but why do Apple advertisers have that privilege? They didn't used to be able to have really targeted ads. So, but, digression. But related to this is that these, what I'm saying now is a modern browser, it has to run JavaScript at different privilege levels. It has to run JavaScript at the privilege level of an extension, and when it runs an extension, it has to follow a permission model, or it has to run it with the privilege model of a in a web page, which does not have access generally to the system. You should hear complexity, you should hear errors, you should hear mistakes will be made. And they are. People periodically find out things, and particularly with extensions, But extensions are normally, people think of, well, if you're going to install an extension, you should trust it. But that's really not the case either. So this is an ongoing thing that's evolving. What does it mean to have extensions that have additional privileges that you don't trust? It's kind of like apps in a mobile operating system, except these extensions can potentially see every web page you visit. Like, I love the pop-ups. Like, if you install the Firefox, I just yesterday installed the Facebook extension for Firefox. And when I installed it, it has a little pop-up that says what privileges it wants. It says, this can see every web page you visit. And it kind of has to, given the permission model that is currently there. It has to monitor everything in order to be able to decide what to interpose and what not to interpose on. But you gotta go like, oh, that's just, no. Why can't it just have a permission of, I have to be available on these domains, I will be loaded. Why can't it say that? Because Google's the one who made the permission model first. they really don't make permission models that allow this sort of filtering. Android applications have a permission, you know, I think they might have changed that in the new ones. I don't know. But for a long time, they had had permission to connect to the internet. That was a permission. You can talk to the internet. It's like, I don't want you talking to anyone on the internet. Maybe your home server, maybe one other thing, but any website, anything on the internet? I mean, what could you be doing? I mean, that's not fine-grained permissions. I mean, that's the opposite of what we do with firewalls. But yet, this is what was baked into Android. Now, iOS is really not much better on this. It doesn't have except that with iOS they have vetting, and part of the vetting is they're looking at where things go. But still, it's iOS is better. I wouldn't say it's great from a privacy standpoint, but it's as good as there is right now. So all this is saying what are we trying to do? There, I still haven't really talked about sandboxing. So in the context of all this, what the heck is sandboxing? What is this really? What? Isolating code. Right? When we say we want to sandbox code, it means that we want to provide We want to limit the code that what it can access in some way, kind of like a process. A process is kind of a sandbox, but it's a very leaky sandbox in the sense of there's lots of things a process can do. So if I really want to sandbox something, I really want to limit, we're saying we want to limit what it can do. The metaphor comes from, I want it to play in this sandbox and I don't want it to make a mess outside of it. Go play in there. The metaphor doesn't really take into account that actual kids with real sandboxes, sand gets everywhere. But that's the metaphor. So what do those mechanisms look like? I mean, partly it's, you could say one way of, sandboxing is an aspiration. It's what you want. It says nothing about the technology that you use for doing it. It's saying the goal that you have. And there's a lot of tricks with which to do it. Because you realize when you're doing this, like, what's real sandboxing? I mean, you could say an entire operating system is kind of sandboxed by a hypervisor. That kind of does some sandboxing. You'd say, but limiting a process and limiting things within a process? Okay, I could use a language runtime to implement an abstraction so as to prevent certain things. And so that, I can implement arbitrary logic here. With the understanding that in the context of a just-in-time compiler and all the complexity of these things, the more complex rules I try to implement here, the more potential for errors there are.
But are there other ways? Any of you heard of NACL, Native Client? So, before there was WebAssembly, and I think even before, before there was WebAssembly, there was something called ASM.js. ASM.js was Mozilla's solution for running code fast in the browser. And the idea there was just, we want to compile arbitrary code down to a bytecode. But that bytecode, we want to run not in an arbitrary runtime. We want to run that bytecode in JavaScript. So the insight they had is that if we just pick a subset of JavaScript syntax, we can make a bytecode which actually is JavaScript. So it doesn't require another runtime. It will run inside of a JavaScript runtime. But because it has certain semantics, we can also compile it even more efficiently than we can regular JavaScript. We can really make it down to real machine code and make it run really fast. So it's providing ASM.js was about providing a subset of JavaScript that looked like a bytecode that could be thus interpreted, and compiled very fast by a just-in-time compiler. So you'd have language, you could have specialized optimizations for it, but even runtimes that didn't know about it could still run it okay. As you might guess, this proposal had a competitor from the Google side. The Google's side competitor was something called NACL, Native Client. Salt. But they called it Native Client. And the idea of Native Client is that why not just run x86 machine code in a browser? But sandbox. So that was the idea. Let's sandbox it, but run x86 machine code. Now you might be going, what? How do you do that? Well, it turns out that if you restrict the instructions that are allowed. I mean, there are certain instructions that are clearly privileged in x86 machine code that allow you to do software interrupts or other things. Well, what if you just remove those? Can you just have a little thing that runs through the code and removes all those instructions? And by removing all those instructions, then you have safe code. And maybe you have to add some special things for whatever interfaces you want. So it can't do system calls and other things like you would do normally. But basically, it's filtered machine code. But that means it's machine code, so it can run directly in the processor. And you just need to have something that makes sure that before the machine code runs, it checks to make sure it's safe. That was the sandboxing. Subset it. Not a crazy idea. But it turns out x86 has lots of quirks. Lots of quirks, variable length instructions, other things, making it actually kind of hard to analyze. It really wasn't designed for static analysis, which is in effect what you have to do. And so they put out this proposal and they said, everyone, let's have machine code and let's analyze it and stuff like that. People go, oh, look, I can break your verifier. Oh, look, I can break your verifier. So there are all these bugs in Native Client. And they kind of patched them up, and it seemed pretty good and stuff. But then, of course, Google realized, wait a second, not everyone runs Intel chips. What about all those ARM chips? And we want to compile things to this. So they made portable NACL, i.e. a bytecode. So they made a bytecode language, and thus... Now you have the abstraction that you can do this, and now you translate this into there, and now you can do all your interposition and whatever. And also, it's simpler than like Java bytecodes and stuff like that, because they're not trying to implement all kinds of weird permission models and stuff like that. All the codes are going to want the same permissions. So it's a simpler problem. So that's great. But so there was competing standards. Google had their
portable native client binaries, and Firefox had these things, and Firefox looked over at the Google folks and going like, this is very silly. Okay, now you have a bytecode runtime interpreter, and you have to have a JavaScript runtime. You have two of them that you have to make sure you get right. Why are you doing this? This seems dumb. Why not just do it with one? And oh, look, see? We can make it really efficient. See? ASM.js.
It's hard work you put into V8.
And then they finally have had their standards discussions and everything, and the result is WebAssembly, which is a bytecode format, which I don't know if it's strictly a JavaScript subset anymore, but it's close enough. So anyway, they standardize this, and I think the idea is that it's enough so that it can be simply added to any JavaScript runtime, so you don't have to implement a different sandbox for everything that runs inside JavaScript. And that has a real advantage because now, since it's running inside JavaScript, it can integrate with native web technologies. So you could have things written in C or C++ compiled down to WebAssembly and accessing the DOM. That's kind of the vision. That also might be the horror. But, yeah. So, when you hear the word sandboxing, what the lesson I want you to take from this is, sandboxing is not a technology. Sandboxing is a goal. Sandboxing is saying, I'm going to limit the access of this code to other things outside of it. The tricks that are used are typically things like, let me filter the code before it to make sure it can't do any bad things. Let me try doing some sort of runtime interposition. Maybe I can do some CPU tricks. Maybe I can use some specialized code. Sometimes the OS, newer operating system now are providing mechanisms to help sandbox things, basically specialized processes. Processes that have no access. Or like, you know, instead of them being able to make system calls, they have to actually call one other process, and that process is going to decide what happens. So modern versions of Windows have this, and it's used for implementing Edge. That's one of the ways they're getting better browser security, is by implementing this. And I think Chrome and other folks are starting to use the technology Microsoft has implemented. And Linux folks are similarly doing these kind of sandboxing, and that's in the realm of containers. And again, what a container is actually a less privileged set of processes, which typically means that these are sets of processes that have their system calls filtered in some way. They cannot make certain system calls, and maybe they have other kinds of restrictions. But at the end of the day, sandboxing is just what you're trying to do. It's not a technology. And looking at the actual tricks people do to do sandboxing, you kind of go like, ooh, that's messy. Ooh, that's not pretty. But it's typically because they're trying to do sandboxing in the context of a process, which was not designed to be sandboxed and does not have hardware support. Where sandboxing is getting cleaner is where operating systems are providing support. And the big support is, why can't you have a process with less privileges? It's just some more OS code. The OS code is already enforcing all your permission boundaries. It already has the support of the hardware for doing all this. So it's minimal complexity to add this additional things on. You just have to define the APIs. And then also figure out who can do this, because now you get these weird things of being able to create. You sometimes can get some situation where you create processes that have like memory that others can't access, and so all of a sudden now you have things you can't introspect. You always have to be careful where you put your boundaries. Sometimes you can cause more problems than you'd expect. But that's all details. So don't, whenever say, oh, it's sandboxed. Really? Is it really? You sure? How'd you do that? As compared to like a process. And okay, so we still have a little more time. So I can talk about. Let's go back to containers. I can talk more about that. So this gets back to, when I say sandbox, it's not a static technology. We talk about some operating systems do sandboxing of apps. what are we talking about? There's a kind of virtualization that I have not talked about, I don't think, which is OS level virtualization. Have I talked about that?
Docker and LXC or something else?
Well, that is
part of it, but yeah. But have I talked about that?
I think you mentioned it a little bit before.
I mentioned it. Okay, so OS virtualization is at the heart of things like modern apps on mobile phones, on mobile OSs, and for containers on the server. It's the same basic stuff. And what that basic stuff is realizing that when you have your user land, so now this is nothing to do with hypervisors. You have your hardware, and you have your processes saying, well, why can't we put a box around some of these? That's all it is. It's basically saying, you're all going to run on top of the same kernel, but we're going to isolate you so that all processes cannot see each other. Maybe they can't access the same resources. Maybe some of them can only access certain parts of the file system. Maybe some of them can't access any of the file system. They have, in effect, these are separate user lands that are isolated from each other or maybe have only limited means of communication. Before the modern era, this was actually very common in one specific context, web hosting. So the idea with web hosting is I want to be able to, install my PHP, I want to, control the web server I'm running, I want to be able to have my files and stuff. So these hosting providers would need to provide this level of access, shell level access often, to a web developer so they can manipulate their website. But they want to be able to host lots of different websites. So how do you keep them from stepping on each other? I mean, you could run entirely separate operating systems for each of them, but it's like, I have 50 customers, do I really need to run 50 kernels when each of them is only running like one or two processes? I mean, it's kind of wasteful. Because that's the insight of OS level virtual is that, well, we'll stick them all in the same kernel. And we'll give them each separate user lands. So the process IDs in each of these are separate, the user accounts are separate, and as you might imagine, there's a, just like with full virtual, instead of a host OS, you kind of have a host one here, one of these things with processes that actually has access to see everything on the system. Fully privileged one. So the system administrator of the system would be able to do this. They can manage their customers. But in here, they are living in an isolated world, but that's good enough. They can run their web servers. They can, do what they want. And have much higher efficiency than if you had to run multiple kernels. Now, what's the disadvantage of doing this?
You have an Achilles heel.
Which is what? Well, the hypervisor has that, with kernels. It's not so much that, though it's not very far from it. Were these kernels designed to do this? Not really. And in particular, how is resource sharing going to happen between these things? Like, for example, process scheduling, or I/O bandwidth, or networks. I mean, modern kernels are not designed to really box in things. They're designed to sort of do a best effort. Oh, you want those resources? Here you go. Oh, you want these resources? Here you go. So you can have contention. One of these really misbehaves, it can really make the other suffer. There isn't strong isolation from a resource usage perspective. It's much easier to implement strong resource isolation at the level of the hypervisor. Because a hypervisor, the abstraction is kind of the hardware, and you just say, okay, you're going to get
know, 30% of the bandwidth of the disk here, you can get this much network bandwidth. I mean, it's just at a level of abstraction where partition is a little bit easier. Partitioning here, that requires a kind of resource accounting that classic Unix systems were not designed to do. So it's not so isolated. And also, you potentially have information leaks between those that are harder to play. It's just, you don't have the level of isolation. And that's why the modern cloud is normally built on virtualizing the kernel and just having separate ones. We pay the resource cost having separate kernels in order to have stronger isolation guarantees, but at the cost of lower efficiency. So this is not used as much. Although, whenever people talk about serverless architectures, that's such a joke, serverless architecture. I mean, it's just like, manage fine, serverless, come on. But in those kind of architectures, what often is running underneath is they've done some sort of user land isolation. It's like, I'm going to have a service provider run my Node.js application. What's the runtime in it? How isolated is that Node.js process from all the others? You hope they aren't doing pure just on the Node.js runtime, but it's not. I wouldn't trust it that far. They're probably doing something like OS level virtualization. Now, the modern version of this is in two forms. One is mobile operating systems, primarily iOS. iOS does exactly this between each application. Each one sees its own user land. This is why iOS applications by default cannot share files. There is not a common file system for them to access. Now, a big change now is that there is a files app. But again, the files app is a privileged app that allows you to see files from different apps. And actually, I think even the apps have to opt in to use that storage. They still, it's not like you can see every file on the file system on an iOS system. You can only see the ones that they designated to put in the area that share that other systems can see. But in effect, they all see, they have their own private files. They can't even see their other processes. They can't send that signals to them. They're separated. How does Android do isolation? Anyone know? So first off, they have, it's a bunch of Java apps, kind of. I mean, it's Android's Java, but so before they would run on something called Dalvik, now they're running on Arc. Basically, it's a new just-in-time compiled environment. So by the way, the bytecodes that Android apps use are not the same as Oracle Java bytecodes. Mm-hmm. Now, remember this whole lawsuit over that Google may owe Oracle $5 billion or something like that because of API copying. It's basically because Google went and took the high-level API of Java in order to do their things, but then did other things to make it kind of different, and basically like, well, you didn't make it different enough, so you actually infringed their copyright. I won't talk about that. But what I will say is that, so the Java model, the Android model, is kind of like, it's basically using Java more to enforce the permissions. It's more like a language runtime type thing, that there's one thing called system manager, which is kind of in its own process, but Android processes are not nearly as isolated as standard Unix processes because they have this thing called binder, which enables very high-speed inter-process communication using shared memory. So it's mediated by the kernel, but it's the permissions really are not enforced at the kernel separating these things. It's much more, there's a thing called system manager, which is this thing that kind of says, oh, are you allowed to send messages to this? And messages between different things are kind of interposed by this. So it's kind of more of a language runtime type interpretation, which has a certain amount of flexibility, but leads to lower quality isolation. But that's why you can hack on your Android phone and make it do all kinds of weird things. But that's also why Android apps can really mess with you much more than iOS apps. Because
they're not using OS level containers, they're using language level runtime protections with the permission model there. That also means the Apple model is hard, it takes more work to add in connections between it because they basically have to punch holes in these things as you know, as they want. And if they want to punch these holes carefully, so where am I now? Oh, I am out of time. So the last thing is Docker and which I can talk a little about, but basically it's the same stuff. The only difference with modern containers and OSs is it's about taking this thing and packaging it up in a nice way. So the idea is that since this is all self-contained, I can package it up and ship it around, and that has all the dependencies I need. So the isolation is actually secondary to the packaging effort, and it's seen in the permission things. Traditional Docker containers actually do not have strong isolation. And in fact, only now have they been adding the OS infrastructure to and using it properly to make these pretty isolated. But again, the isolation is not as strong as a full kernel-level virtualization. Okay, I will see.